sitting in sole possession of first place. This is Bob McCowan on Canada's most listened to sports radio program, Primetime Sports, on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
It's hard to believe that song is 50 years old.
Holds up pretty well. Like, it's... I wouldn't say I'm the biggest Beatles fan ever. But...
Well, see, that was my band.
Nobody doesn't like that song, I don't think.
Well, I don't know. It's hard to... I mean, again, I grew up with the Beatles. I was at the concert at Maple Leaf Gardens in 1964. I was there.
How was that?
It was really loud. That's all I remember. And you
because
couldn't
of the
really
crowd or because
screaming.
Of the,
yeah. Yeah. Because it was the screaming era. Right?
Now, when you went, were they in your mind? Were like, what's going on here?
That's because you got, yeah. You
can't okay. That. Something's
it's up too loud and you got it. You can't there do that.
Okay. Now, did you feel like it was like a cultural phenomenon at the time, or was it like really cool because the girls were in it? Like, you were a kid.
I was a kid, man. You know,
you didn't have the social, you didn't have it placed in a context.
I mean, look at this was, I mean, you know, even in retrospect, it's hard to imagine a band since then in the last 50 years that has had the kind of impact that the Beatles had at that point in time, and certainly when they came to North America. Yeah. I mean, U2 is a big band. It's a big, big band. And I've been to a bunch of U2 concerts. It's not the same.
No. I mean, the one thing that jumps out at me is, I mean, I read Keith Richards' book last year. And, you know, when you're reading that era of rock and roll history, it's brand new.
Yeah, it
right?
was.
Right? That's the thing that kind of you keep returning to over and over again is that The first time the Beatles went through it was the first time anybody
had ever gone through anything like that.
You take,
well, Elvis to some extent.
Yeah.
But as a band, no, nobody.
Right. And you know, the Rolling Stones, a different genre entirely, and they took it in a whole new direction. But again, the first time.
Yeah.
And there's a place, there's a bar on Queen Street called Stone's Place that's kind of like a tribute, I guess, to the Rolling Stones.
Oh, really? To the Stones?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think they have some relationship with the band. I don't know exactly the details. But,
oh, really?
But if you go in there, there's a concert review from, I think it's written by Peter Goddard, the old Toronto Star rock and roll critic forever and ever, of the Rolling Stones playing at Maple Leaf Gardens. I'm definitely going to get the year wrong, but I'm going to say it's like 1972, 1970. It's like that era, like sort of just as they crested from being kind of a rock and roll band to being like
iconic
devil worshiping end of society type.
Yeah.
Anyway, and so you read this review in the Toronto Star, and you know, it's just on your way down to the washroom, you know, it's pasted on the wall there, and it just takes you back and you wonder what it would have been like. You know, it was a 90 degree July night. I'm getting the dates and facts wrong, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And to be like a 22 year old from North Toronto going in to see the Rolling Stones at Maple Leaf Gardens. Like, there's no equivalent now to
really
that.
Really isn't, no.
Right? Because every concert is
It's been done.
It's been done. It's an echo of that. It doesn't mean it's not as good or important or interesting or entertaining or talented or whatever. But that, like, in terms of space and time, you read a review like that and you're like, this was, nobody really had ever seen anything like this before, you know? And then the Beatles would be another layer of that.
So define for me here. Are you a music guy?
I'm a music guy who's been cut off of the legs by work, job, and kids. So,
all right. So we acknowledge the Beatles and the significance of their careers. The Rolling Stones, crap, are still going at it in their 70s now.
Right.
God bless them. It's a phenomenon, but it, you know. They're still at it. U2 probably is you know, the biggest band in the world right now of, you know, are we going to ever see? I mean, is there anybody that fits that Beatles Stones category? Has there been anybody in the last 35 years? There's been flashes. There have been groups, individuals who have rocketed to success, but haven't been able to maintain it.
Yeah,
I'm trying to think. It's the hard. Only one that comes to mind, and I mean, even they are more niche than omnipopular would be the Eagles. You know, when they were and going again, in the 70s. Like
40 years past, right? Like,
yeah.
Like so the question would be, is there a band not yet invented or that, you know, your kid or my kid is going to be talking about 50 years hence?
Yeah.
Yeah. It would seem almost impossible. And you know, just because the music industry just seems to become so commoditized, and I don't necessarily see it as bad, but I just can't imagine, you know, one artist being able to stand over everything and not get swept away by the next tide. Like it has nothing to do with the caliber or quality of the artists.
Well, it's
more
the staying power, the ability to do it for long periods of time, and the willingness to do it. And let's face it, the Beatles were only together as we knew them for less than a decade.
Well, that's in some ways
now, they started, I think, in the late 50s or 1960. Playing in Germany and Hamburg and in those little bars, and we all know the stories.
Right.
But by 70, they're gone.
Yeah, I think it's that's part of their success, right?
So you think if the Beatles, I don't want to dwell on this, but do you think if the Beatles had lasted another decade, we'd look at them differently?
I mean, we look at the Stones differently, right? Like you look at the Stones now as a curiosity and, you know, but I would argue has probably diminished how potent they were a message and a force at their peak in the mid 70s.
Yeah.
Like they've kind of.
Well, no, you can't maintain that forever and ever.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like why is Jimi Hendrix.
But having said that.
Unassailable is because he died before he could ruin himself.
Yeah. Well, but the interesting part though
sadly,
is, I mean, still today, McCartney is relevant. McCartney still has a huge fan base. McCartney can still draw big crowds. And for 20 years after the Beatles, produced relevant music.
Sure he did.
John Lennon, until he was assassinated, was producing relevant music. I mean, the significance of that band, I think, is far beyond what they captured during that 6 or 7 years.
Yeah.
They really had a skill set, a true talent.
I mean, I think the key there is they were first. There's no doubt that, you know, that they were special in their own right. And as a result, they created a brand's probably not the right word, but like they just have lasted unassailably, you know? And it's hard for somebody new to come along and do that. I think there's hip hop artists because they started something new. That have kind of
maybe
some
that's
of them
true.
Have achieved that.
Yeah, I know so little about the hip hop,
you know,
culture.
Like, and I'm not saying I do either, but you're
maybe there's
about,
somebody in there that I'm just
few.
Not even aware
there's
of.
There's a few.
I just had Wayne Parrish on.
Good Wayne, yes.
And you're a basketball guy and have been for a long time. And I queried him on Bennett and Olenek and Wiggins and will we see these guys in Rio? Will we see them between now and Rio? And he has a level of confidence that's going to happen. But you know, we've been disappointed before.
Yes.
When it comes to basketball, but I don't know if there's anybody of this stature necessarily, other than Nash, but Nash played for the Olympic team and for the team
for
Canada
yes. mm-hmm.
until he got to a certain age where he said, you know, I've done my bit. And we all thought that was okay. He gave. It's okay now. At, you know, age 35 or whatever he was, to say enough of that. Are you confident these guys are going to play?
I think so. I think the where Canada basketball got in trouble in the past was always there was only one or two of these guys, and so if Jamal McGlure didn't play,
which he never did,
they just stuck out like a sore thumb, and the issue was. But so without getting sidetracked, I think they will. I think one reason they will is that Jerry Colangelo and USA Basketball and Kobe Bryant and LeBron James and Kevin Durant have made playing for your national team and going to the Olympics a very cool thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, that pride and sweater, I think it's they've
but it didn't affect McGlor. I mean, McGlor was around during that whole time when it was, you know.
Going back
to Barcelona, you can go all the way back to Barcelona with the first Dream Team.
Yes.
You know, and that predates Jamal McGlor.
Right. Well, McGlor played, I want to say he played in 90. He did play 1 year.
But at the peak of his career, he chose not to play.
And in his defense, not that I'm going to go way down that road, but in his defense, most of the turning points where it was a choice for him to play or not were contract issue years for him. So he was in situations where...
All right, so let me throw this in perspective then.
But
Anthony Bennett, number one draft choice of Cleveland. Entry-level contract is how long in the NBA? Three years.
2 years plus a team option. So,
three.
Yeah.
Guess what happens in 2016?
He'd be a free agent. That'd be... Well, by that time, he'll probably have already got an extension. Probably.
Maybe.
But also, the Olympics are August-ish.
That's the summer, though. That's the summer of his second contract in the NBA.
Yeah, but generally, a guy of his stature, presuming he's delivers the way a number one pick should, he'd get wrapped up pretty quick. I think all the guys you've talked about have played for Canada before. Number one,
that's a good sign.
So that's a good sign. Number two is I think amongst that group, there's a lot of relationships built on the summer basketball circuit where they went out and made a splash at these AAU tournaments. And really part of their identity was we're Canada and we're going to stick it to everyone around. And I think to be able to do that on a national, international type stage, I think I've never got any impression from any of them that there would be anything, but that would be something they'd love to do. Number three, I think Canada basketball as an organization is much, much better run than it's ever been, thanks to people like Wayne Parrish. And they have made a concerted effort to touch these guys at younger and more pivotal stages of their development. And I mean, that was an issue with Jamal McGlor, just to pick a name, not to pick on him, was Canada basketball was never really part of his success going up. So he never really felt that he owed them anything in a big way.
So, You don't know how these are all young men who haven't played professional basketball. We haven't seen them in competition with the very best in the world. We're optimistic. Number one draft choice, that's pretty impressive.
And maybe
another number one next year.
Yes.
And Olenek at number 13, that's impressive too. If these guys are what you expect them to be, not what you hope them to be, but what you expect them to be, where does Canada sit?
I've looked at this various times, and the most recent time I looked at this, if you look at the last two or three World Championships and the last two or three Olympics, the average number of NBA type players, that's guys who are either in the league or have been in the league or expected to be in the league on a medalist, mm-hmm. is about seven. Right?
Seven guys. Wow.
Right. Now, at the high end of that is like your Spain and Argentina's, and those are world championship type teams. So,
well, beyond the USA.
Right.
Which
USA is a different
conversation. They're all NBA guys.
But Spain, for example, silver medalist in London, they had, I'm going to say, about 10 guys who had real NBA bonds.
Jobs.
Guys who were either drafted, were playing.
Gotcha.
Thing. Canada should be able to, by 2016, 2018, definitely be able to surpass that. In other words, the only other team in the world that would have as many NBA players to draw from
be the U.S.
would be the U.S.
Really, huh?
And they should, you know, like on paper, they should be able to start five NBA first-round picks and bring 2 to 3 NBA first-round picks off the bench in 2016.
Wow.
Now, the problem there is that would be an extraordinarily young team. Like, your average age would be about 24.
Yeah.
Right? And so, at the Olympics, that's pretty young because the teams that succeed are...
Would that then suggest to you that 2020 is actually the year? that Canada might very well have its, based on what we're seeing
right
now.
Yeah, I mean, demographically, 2020 would be the year, if everything lines up.
These guys would be at the peak of their career.
These would be at the peak. And
the key
and,
players.
Yes. But that doesn't mean they couldn't happen in 2016. And that doesn't mean any of it will happen, unfortunately.
Doesn't mean any of it will play.
It's not a joke. I hate to tell you.
No, I know, but that's why we're talking about it, because it's the first time in my lifetime that we've actually been in a position to even have this conversation.
100%. And it could be the first time, the last time, too, which isn't to say that Canada can't become a consistent contender on the world stage, but let's be honest.
It's like, hard to imagine back-to-back number ones.
Have five lottery picks in the space of 3 years?
No, it doesn't.
Every 3 years?
No, that doesn't. That's not likely, is it? We got to take the break. We'll switch to baseball and plenty of interesting stuff to discuss. Greg Zahn will wander in here in a moment. This is Primetime on The Fan and Sportsnet.
It's Brady and Lang in the morning. Tomorrow morning, 5:30 to 9. Now, more of Bob McCowan and Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Twenty-two minutes past the hour. McCowan here, Grange over there. Greg Zahn joins us in studio. So usually I go on vacation and nothing really happens. And if it does happen, I don't really care about it. But I got to tell you, I was pissed.
You and a lot of other people.
When Aaron Sibbia went off on you and Hayhurst.
Mm-hmm. He's not pissed for the same reason you think he's pissed.
Oh, really?
No.
Well, mostly because I can't believe I got left out of it.
Oh.
If he was going to dump on somebody, shouldn't he have started with me?
Well.
Or is it because you're an ex-player? Is that?
I think his perception of my analysis is that I've somehow forgotten how hard it was to play the game in the 3 years since I retired. Unfortunately for him, I remember how easy it was for me to do certain things, like catch the baseball, block it, and make it stay right in front of me. I had my ups and downs with throwing the baseball based on surgeries, but he didn't really have that excuse just yet. And I've been a proponent of his in a lot of ways.
You were a defender of his when I was critical of him at the
no
beginning.
No doubt. No,
you were.
I always take an honest look at the catchers. Now, I'm not be the first to admit that I'm hard on guys. I mean, I expect a lot out of a guy. The first thing I expect him to be able to do is catch the baseball. So when a guy leads the league in pass balls year after year, it's embarrassing, and it's not right. And I know this guy has so much more in him than we've seen.
So why? First of all, I want to get to what he said and what happened. But
okay,
analytically, why is this guy not getting it? Why is Do you think his work ethic is weak?
According to him, it's not.
According to him, what do you think?
I don't know. I don't hang around and watch. I'm not going to show up there at 3:30 in the afternoon to watch.
See what he does.
Thing. No,
yeah.
I haven't. I will say this: the days where I am there early, you know, and this few and far between. He was right. I don't go down to the batting cage during BP.
Well, neither do I.
I know.
I'm not interested.
But I'm in the building, and he knows where I am, and he has my phone number and my email address, so he has access to me. Anybody else that wants me knows where to find me. All they got to do is turn around and say, hey, Zahnny, can we talk for a second, and I'll come right down. But for me to go down there and glad hand and listen to all the nonsense, I did that for 22 years. I'm over it.
Yeah.
I just want to go to work, analyze the ball game, do my job, and go home. I got a life. I got other things going on.
Dirk went down to talk to him.
Yeah, he did. He did.
Did you talk to Dirk after that conversation?
Yes, I did.
And how did Dirk evaluate that discussion? Did he think JP was receptive?
No, I don't. I think JP was very forthcoming with what he said to Dirk. It was also very, very evident that he has a very, shall we say, warped view of reality. I believe Dirk had was having a conversation with him, and JP said something to him about a specific argument about how we should be skewing his performance in a positive way for the fans.
Really?
And he brought up the specifics, and I may be wrong on this. I might not be, about how he wanted us to talk about where he ranked in the American League as far as RBIs by a catcher. And I thought to myself, who cares? You're hitting a buck 40 with runners in scoring position. That's just about opportunity. How am I supposed to skew that? And I think the words top 10 in the league came up, and I was like, there's only 15 teams in the league, so why is that so great? It's not that great. Look, I like the kid. I'm very hurt. I'm disappointed by his comments, especially the ones of a personal nature. I thought that was hitting below the belt. But I'm also a little disappointed that, like I said, he's had my phone number. He's had my email address. He knows where to find me. I don't need to go down to the field every day and make sure that everybody's okay with the way I'm analyzing their performance. Are you okay? Can I do anything to make your life better? Come on. There ain't nobody ever did anything for me. They never held my hand. In fact, I got the brutal side of the game, and I had to earn every bit of it. And so for somebody to say that I don't remember how hard it was to play, it's absolutely ridiculous. It's one of the most insane comments I've ever heard.
All right. Anything else you want to throw in this pile?
One thought I had when I was down there, you know, when he was doing his follow-up to his morning interview. He did his afternoon interview. And one thing, as I was watching it there's a really good article Shai Davidi wrote where he interviewed Chad Mottola about him and his hitting approach regarding Aaron Sebia. And basically, there's a great line by Chad saying, like, I believe people's personalities come out in their baseball swing or their approach at the plate. And that the big issue they're having with Aaron Sebia was he just couldn't wait. Like, he just, you know, he had no patience. I mean, it shows in his walk totals and the number of pitches he takes in season. In other words, and then, you know, you take that, and then you see him kind of calling radio stations, calling a shot on radio stations, and then following up with many press conferences about what he said on the radio station. Just this is kind of sense that he can attack whatever the issue is and make it all happen as he would like. And I, anyway, long way of saying, I just wonder if the two are related. Like, this guy just does not understand how to let things come and be patient and be analytical and benefit from that.
Well, that part of it I can't say. I wouldn't look at him and talk to him and say he's a real cerebral baseball player. He's more of a talent guy, more of a you know, reaction kind of guy. He's got good power. And it's funny you say, you know, personalities can come out in a baseball swing. How do you approach your at bats? Well, I've heard people say that he approaches his bats selfishly because all he tries to do is hit homers. Now, I defended him on that one because as a manager, armchair manager, I would be like, look, I don't need you on the base paths after a single, okay? If you're up there with nobody on base, I want you to try to hit a double or better. I need you in scoring position, or I need you to hit one out of the ballpark. When there's runners in scoring position, I need you to cut down your swing and drive runners in.
Yeah, sure, that's common sense.
That's what I need you to do. It's not hit a home run every time. I'll accept the high strikeout totals if the strikeouts are coming in the right situations where he's been told, go up there and try to hit a homer. Go up there and try to hit swing for extra bases. He's got power to all fields, so there's no reason for him to be pull happy. He can hit. I mean, we've seen him go opposite field so many times. First home run of his career, opposite field.
But when you talk to him, I mean, he would describe himself as, I'm a run producer. I want the bat in my hand with two guys on. I want the pressure on. I want this. And yet, to listen, my interpretation of what Mottola was saying was, yeah, he gets up there and it's like he can't control himself. He's just hacking and,
well,
you know,
to me,
all or nothing.
To me, the proof's in the pudding. Are you really a run producer? Has he driven in 75 to 100 runs yet in his career? Does he hit over 300 with runners in scoring position? Miguel Cabrera is a run producer. Prince Fielder is a run producer. Yeah. You know, Jose Bautista, Edwin Encarnacion, those guys are run producers. You know, and one might even argue that Jose's batting average with runners in scoring position is a little low, but you can't argue with the total. The guy drives in runs. Colby Rasmus, with the opportunities that he's been given, has produced a lot of runs.
Yeah, you have to admit.
Mark DeRosa is producing a lot of runs for the amount of plate appearances.
And so what does that reflect about their relative approach? I mean, Rasmus is a guy who you would have put in the same boat as Aaron Sebia last year, and yet he seems to be kind of developing and advancing in a more technical, cerebral approach.
He has his way. I mean, I still can't figure out what kind of approach these guys are going up there with in certain situations. Because when I look at the swings and I look at where the balls are being hit, based on situation, based on the people that are on the mound, and I'll be the first to admit, Colby Rasmus, I mean, one of the most talented guys in the game, pure talent. J.P. Arencibia could be way up there, too. He could be a lot better than he is all the way around. Still wondering about the approach a little bit. I'd have to sit down and really chit-chat with these guys about it. But I don't want them to feel like that I'm attacking them. It seems like anytime you're critical of this group, it feels like they go on the offensive or the defensive, and they don't understand that, you know, this is our job. You know, we're not the fans. We're not here to love you. We're here to analyze what you do on the field, good or bad. And so I was really taken aback by the fact that, you know, there, people would say that I was unfair, or JP would say that I was unfair and that I was always negative. That's not true at all. Jamie Campbell is probably the most equal guy I've ever seen in my life. And until he tells me that I am unfair and I am negatively skewing things all the time, I'm not going to believe anything anybody tells me, because here's a professional broadcaster. He loves the Blue Jays. He bleeds for this club, and he'll be the first one to tell you we're fair. You play well, we talk about it. You play poorly, we talk about it.
So with the fundamental issues that both of us believe exist in Arencibia and to some extent in Rasmus, and their strikeout totals are reflective of that, is it the responsibility, based on your experience, is it the responsibility of the manager, the hitting coach, whoever, to get these guys to change, adapt? Or is it the individual's responsibility?
I always come back to players play, coaches coach. You can coach a guy so well. You could say all the right things to him. But if they don't listen to you, they're never going to get any better. Colby Rasmus, I'm not sure what his approach at the plate is, because, or whether he sits on pitches or guesses, but he gets beat by mediocre fastballs. We're talking 90, 91 mile an hour fastballs, which is mediocre by today's standards, especially if it doesn't have great movement, in hitters counts. Now, to me, take care of the fast. If you're a guy that strikes out a lot, just take care of the heater. Forget about it. The best way to hit a curveball is don't miss the fastball. If the guy can throw you three curveballs and one at bat for strikes,
tip your cap and go sit down. Yeah.
You know, maybe pick one pitch where you're going to sit on that breaking ball. But Colby has, if you look at his swing pattern is shaped like a V.
Yeah.
The barrel goes into the zone, it comes flying out of the zone. So his window for crisp contact is very, very small. It should be a U-shaped swing, a nice smooth arc, not a jagged check mark. There's one of his major problems as far as contact and striking out goes. The JP, his problem is probably a combination of both.
I'll tell you,
approach.
It's balance, though. His balance when at any pitch that's not on the inside half of the plate is horrific. Watch him. Watch the number of times he loses his balance and steps across the plate when he doesn't even swing on any pitch outside. It speaks to what you were talking before. He's chasing. He wants to swing at every pitch that's thrown. He may not swing at them all, but he wants to.
Well, he wants to swing, and I don't blame him.
And if his front foot is stepping towards the plate and he's reaching out where he can't hold his balance, then he's got a problem. And that's a fundamental technical problem that should be correctable.
Well,
and that's what puzzles me about why he just over and over and over again continues to do it. Now, and we're not here to pick on him. We're in the course of the conversation.
You were on vacation last week. You're asking me what happened that you weren't here. I'm just telling you, he's got a chance to be a good player, but, you know, at some point, honest evaluation of yourself is necessary in order to get better and in order to change. And, you know, to point the finger at me and attack me personally because you're sore about the way you're playing the game and you're miserable because you're going to be arbitration eligible at the end of the year, and every week that goes by, thousands of dollars are coming off of your contract. Not my fault. I'm here to evaluate the performance, and when it's good, I'm going to talk about it.
We got to go 15 seconds. Cleveland tonight. Long time the Cleveland Indians have been a soft touch, Not so much anymore.
No, they can play. That's a pretty complete
It's a pretty
ball
good
club.
Ball club over
Johnson's
there.
Johnson's going to need to have some fastball command tonight. He's been very poor in the middle of the zone.
Just told Brett Laurie is playing second base tonight in Buffalo.
Interesting.
Do you expect to see that when he comes
out? No, I didn't. I didn't see that coming. It's an interesting idea. I've always been worried about his hands. We've talked about that. He's got amazing range, and I think his range and his athleticism is lost on third. But you know what? If he can soften up his hands and make the routine plays at second, we could be in for some fun stuff.
Good to see you. Thanks, pal.
My pleasure.
Greg Zahn of Sportsnet. We'll come back with more. Primetime will continue. You're listening on The Fan, watching on Sportsnet.
Brady and Lang in the morning. Tomorrow morning, 5:30 to 9. Now, more of Bob McCowan and Primetime Sports on Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
Seventeen minutes before the hour, primetime continues for this Tuesday, the 9th of July, on the Fan and Sportsnet Coast to Coast. McCowan, Grange, later Scott Niedermeyer, Brendan Shanahan, and others, as this was Hall of Fame Day for hockey. I was going to say the National Hockey League, which in essence is what it is, but it's not really, for hockey in general. So we'll get to that in the next hour. In studio now, he needs no introduction. He's an Olympic gold medalist. Here's Simon Whitfield. Good to see you. How are you?
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm good. Survived the flood. I'm all good.
Did you get wet?
I tried not to. I stayed in my hotel.
You'd be fine, though. You can swim.
Just swim away from all those cars. It was great. Yeah. What's the problem?
So you're involved with a new program, a mentorship and funding program. How is this different from anything else we've seen or heard?
They haven't really combined. No one else has combined the two. And in essence, they've got these grants that will go out. Here's a grant.
Here's some money.
See you later. Which is great. Don't get me wrong. They have some sort of mentoring programs, but not as formal as this. So we've taken 60. We're going to take 67 young athletes. CIBC team next. We've got six mentors: Bruni Surin, Mary Spence, Kara Lang,
yep,
myself. We've got a great group. We get to be assigned a group. And we start mentoring. And it's great. It's a great opportunity for me because I had a lot of great mentors coming up.
So mentor versus coach, what is the fundamental difference in your mind?
I don't know. I won't know a lot about
their
sport.
They get to complain to you about their coach.
Yeah, they do. That's, you absolutely nailed it. And I know there's some coaches sitting out there going, wait a minute. No, it's a sounding board. I mean, Marnie McBean for me, that was my mentor. Right into Sydney, had a lot of advice from her. After Sydney, how to deal with it, the pressure of Athens. I always went back to Marnie and asked her every time, you know, what I do. And after London, after I crashed, she was one of the first people I talked to. So that kind of role had nothing to do with coaching, had nothing to do with workouts. It was, you know,
experience.
And this pressure. And Marnie really said to me a lot of times, like, pressure is good. That means there's opportunity here. And really, in a calm and collected way, just explain that out. Like, wait a minute, you've got an opportunity here. And she's a multiple time medalist, world champion.
So who are the athletes that you will mentor? At what stage of development will they be when you get a hold of them?
I keep describing them as the people who just got kicked out of home. So the parents have said, okay, you know, you are now 20 years old. It is time to, you know, go along here. You're getting an education. That's terrific. You're in school. You're making the transition from competing at a provincial level to a national level, a national level to an international and Olympic Games, hopefully. These young athletes are, they're in that stage. And I remember that stage when mom and dad were kind of like, okay, that's great and all. You want to go back to Japan and race, but you probably need to figure out how to pay for this at some point.
Mm.
That's transition money before you get Olympic team funding, before you get more provincial or national funding. CIBC Team Next gives you the opportunity.
And is that in recognition of, I mean, there is karting money available, but you got to be pretty much world-class generally to qualify.
That's my observation of the glitch in the system right now is it's very hard to get from that point of parental support or community support to that funding level. Often they're saying, well, wait a minute, you know, I'm no longer young enough to considered, you know, the young and up and comer, but I'm not good enough yet to be. So where do I fit in?
Well, especially now because amateur sport, Olympic sport, Olympic sport's not amateur sport, right? And it used to be that transition was, you know, not that long a period, but now you're competing against guys who are into their second or third Olympics.
Oh, absolutely.
So how do you, how do you get to their first Olympics against guys who are in their second or third, I suppose.
Yeah, and then the mentoring part for us is really important. That $5,000 does go a long way. That's a huge help. But to have someone that you can talk to about, you know, the pressure, the expectation, the Olympic year, all those types of things. There's a lot to learn from that.
With Simon Whitfield. So I'm intrigued by this and how this is going to work too. So are you going to sit down, you and your cohorts, and spend finite amounts of time with athletes? Are you available to them on a regular basis? Do they get your cell phone number to call you? Now, what's the commitment here?
Yeah, I could see that as a cell phone. Here's my cell phone number. You feel free to text me anytime. We will chat. I am not available 24/7, but I am available. And it's in the same way that Marty was for so many other athletes. Bruni Cern, who's on the mentoring team, I asked Bruni a lot of questions. I sat down with Bruni after Sydney and said, "Oh man, what have I just got myself into here?" You know, he'd been at a long time right there. And those people were always had time for me. Clara Hughes always had time. Silken Lahman always had time. So I owe this. I mean, I have taken up a lot of time that I cannot give back to those people, but I can certainly pay it forward.
So will you have a different message than Kara will have, and a different message than Bruni would have? Or do you take a bunch of athletes and they listen to you, and Kara takes a bunch of athletes and they listen to her, et cetera?
I would have a different message for sure. I'm sure. I would only talk from my own experience, in fact.
Well, of course, that's all you can do.
Right? But I wouldn't be saying, this is what the program says to do. I would simply say to them, in my experience, this is what happened to me. And I'm going to be working mostly with the kids that are out west, as it makes it more accessible. It means there's so many athletes in Victoria and Vancouver. So I can spend time with them there. I can get out for a bike ride. I love learning about sports. I'm hoping to get a fencer because I love fencing. I want to look after. Oh, at the Olympics, that's what I watched. I watched the foil. I watched the whole thing.
Really?
I was cheering at the TV. I had to sit down. Everyone in the room was looking at me going, what's he so excited about?
Now, have you ever picked up a foil?
Oh, yeah, mucking around. Every kid has. I made one out of wood. Whack my friend with
it.
Every kid loves that. No, I've never tried it, but I'm count me in. I want to try all the sports. I sit down with other Olympians and I'm saying, well, so how does this work? Well, what happens after that? How do you qualify for that?
I guess I'm curious, Simon, and by definition, if you're dealing with a pool of probably 10 or 12 athletes, right? Like your experience is so rare as an Olympic athlete in that, you know, you won a gold medal. You won the first gold medal, right? If that's my math is correct in your sport. And I've been able to be at the forefront of that sport commercially, and I mean, you've made a real career as an Olympic athlete, so to speak. And is that really going to be translatable to most of these kids? Like, how are you going to? Because
yeah, that's
the math
a good question.
Is only one or two of them are going to get to anything
no,
close.
No, for sure, that's a really good question. But I would say that, you know, once every 4 years, my life was all about the Olympics. But in the meantime, but in those other years, it was about World Cups. It was about Continental Cups. It was about national championships. And it was about being just a better athlete, that relentless pursuit all the time. And I got asked that this morning. We were at the park with the kids. We were having fun playing. And one of the questions was, you know, what about the balance? And I said, you know, frankly, for me, it was being wholly committed. It was understanding that I had to be really, every single day, figure out how am I going to get better at this. And so that message would apply whether they were going to the Canada Games, the Pan American Games, or the eventually Olympic Games. I mean, Pan American Games for me, Winnipeg, was the most incredible experience because I got to go through a whole bunch of the ups and downs and the nervousness and seeing the cafeteria and meeting the other athletes. I took that to Olympic Games and it seemed like, you know, felt like, okay, wait a minute, I've already been here. I've already kind of experienced a bit of this. It was a much bigger scale, but I didn't have to jump from zero to you know, the Olympic Games right away.
Are you comfortable? I mean, it's funny that balance is something everyone talks about, but very few really successful people are balanced by any reasonable measure, right? So are you comfortable explaining that? And how do you distinguish between being fully committed and being like obsessive and nuts?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. I have definitely given that message before. And I definitely, when people say to me, I want to lead a balanced, I think, you're in a little bit of trouble there, because it's not. You know, if you want to compete at the highest level in sport, in anything, it takes a certain obsession. My dad used to say, T.S. Garp, get obsessed, stay obsessed. You know, and my dad tried to asterisk it with a healthy obsession, but I could tell that he didn't really mean that. He was like, you get obsessed. If you want to do sport, if that's what your passion is, get obsessed, stay obsessed. And that's what my journey was. I don't know, you know, I suspect that was the same for Marnie. I suspect that was the same for Bruni. I don't know. They'll share a different experience or different take on that.
Is there a, have you gotten to the point where there's one question that is more asked more often than any other?
What was I thinking when I threw my hat? I got the visor question a lot from Beijing, the sprint finish. No, from a mentoring perspective, the balance question does come up a lot. How do I do this? But, and the pressure, people don't like pressure. And I try and say to them, you know, embrace that, accept it.
Did you?
I loved it. There hasn't been an opportunity.
Always? There wasn't a moment where all of a sudden that pressure was...
I cracked in Athens, but it wasn't through not loving it. I just didn't handle it as well as I meant to.
Right.
It affected the way in which I was a leader, and I was a very poor leader going into Athens. But I still loved the pressure. Yeah. I love the idea of being able to get the last shot or do that. I like the, you know, the idea of playing for the championship, and that opportunity's, yeah, awesome.
It's a great opportunity for these young athletes to be in the company of people like yourself and the other mentors. We wish you good luck with this program. I think it can bear a lot of fruit. Good luck, and thanks a lot for sharing it with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Simon Whitfield, Olympic gold medalist. There's Hockey Talk in the next hour in the middle of July. Don't ask me. Scott Niedermayer, Brendan Shanahan, Hall of Famers will both join us. This is Primetime Sports. You're listening on The Fan, watching on Sportsnet.